Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. My guests this week are Sharon Carter Sheridan and Jarvis DeBerry of the Poems and Pink Ribbons Writing Project, and Cornell Landry, whose new book is The Tiger and the Honey Badger Take on the Zoo. And I'll have some thoughts on Katrina reading, which comes around at this time every year. Poems and Pink Ribbons is a poetry writing workshop for breast cancer survivors and those living with breast cancer. It was founded by Kelly Harris DeBerry, and she'd be with us today, but she's having a baby any day now, so she sent two very trusted representatives. Jarvis DeBerry's day job is that of an editorial columnist for the Times-Picayune, but he's a wonderful poet as well, and his work has appeared in Gathering Ground, an anthology of writing from the Cave Canem poets. Sharon Carter Sheridan's day job is working in Orleans Parish Civil District Court for Judge Piper D. Griffin. She's a breast cancer survivor who took part in the initial workshop. She was diagnosed with breast cancer at the age of 47 in 1996, and we are very happy to have her with us today. She served as a Reach to Recovery volunteer for 13 years with the American Cancer Society and is a member of its Mid-South Division's Board of Directors and the Local Executive Leadership Council. She's on the Board of Directors of Xavier University Preparatory High School and the Dryads YMCA, and she's on the dance team for the Hornets. Sharon and Jarvis, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Sharon, how did you get involved with Poems and Pink Ribbons?
I actually saw it on Jarvis's Twitter. And when I saw that, I said, oh, that may be something I could be interested in. So I contacted them and started the program.
And what was that experience like for you?
It was really enlightening because I had written poetry before, but I had never had any kind of formal training. I would just write couplets or write poems for my family members. But going through the workshop, I learned techniques and styles and different phases of poetry that I was not aware of before.
And then at the end of every workshop, there's this celebratory reading where the poets read their work. And what was that like for you? Was that nerve-wracking, or were you ready to come forward by then?
I was a little nervous, but I'm not really shy, so I don't think I had a lot of problems with it. And there were other ladies there who participated, and the other poets, the instructors were there. So they made us all very quite comfortable.
And then you kept on writing over the year, haven't you?
Yes, I continue to write. As a matter of fact, last night I wrote a little book for my granddaughter.
Oh, now that's the best kind of writing.
Yes.
for family members. So you'll be going back again this year?
I can't wait to get started again to get those creative juices flowing.
Oh, that's great. And did you bring a poem to read for us today?
I did. I wrote this poem shortly after I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and it's titled simply After Breast Cancer. My life is simpler and more meaningful. Eyes open wider. My outlook on life is more cheerful. Family is more important after breast cancer. A job is so insignificant. Flowers are more beautiful, grass is greener, the sky is bluer after breast cancer. Birds sing louder. My B cup is half full, not half empty. Calm, peace, and tranquility can be found. Prayer is more intense after breast cancer. Spirituality is deepened. True love is possible. Love is unconditional. God is still the ultimate doctor. After breast cancer.
Thank you, Sharon. I wish you could see her notebook because all of her poems are on beautiful pink paper, too. Now, Jarvis, I know that you lost your mother.
Yes.
To breast cancer, and Kelly's mother survived breast cancer.
Correct. Correct.
So when did you begin thinking about writing about this?
After she came up with the idea, Kelly did, for this event and for this workshop. You know, she talked about it and said, you know, I've always had this idea of doing a poetry workshop for people who've been touched by breast cancer. And I said, well, just do it. Just do it. You know, don't talk about it. Please do it. And, you know, I served as an instructor last year, but you know, for me, it was maybe more therapeutic for me than it was for the women who participated. I hope they got something out of it. And they tell me that they did, but it was as important for me to do it as it was for them to participate.
How do you approach teaching writing in a situation like this?
You know, for my class session, I use a very tough essay called The Aquarium. And it was written by a gentleman whose nine-month-old child died of a very rare form of brain cancer, Alexander Himon. And it was a very agonizing essay to read, but I thought it was important to essentially welcome death into the room and to remind the participants and to remind ourselves that although there are a lot of people who do survive breast cancer, there are still tens of thousands of women who die every year. And that more than anything, this is confronting mortality and confronting, you know, this big bad monster in the room. And I hope that something that we said or did last year gives the women who participated a voice, if only to stand up and yell at this big nasty monster called breast cancer.
Mm-hmm. And how do you find the spirits of the people who come to this workshop?
Amazingly positive and effervescent. And I found that the people who've survived something like that don't take any day for granted. So it was very instructive for me to see the smiles on these women's faces.
People don't understand it, but I find that after cancer, I feel liberated because I'm freer to say and do things that I've never done before. And my daughter will tell me, you will just say anything. And I said, well, you know, after cancer and after getting to be a certain age, you don't hold your tongue. You speak your mind. And that's what cancer has done for me. So in effect, it has been a positive influence on my life, strange as that may seem.
No, I've heard that from other people as well. I think that's the best way to take it, if you can. So, Jarvis, what did it do for you?
It allowed me to mourn probably more than I had before.
Mm-hmm.
I am the older of two children in my family and felt a real responsibility to hold things together and keep things together. And sitting in this workshop and hearing other women read their poetry and go through their experiences, it was permission really to be emotional, to grieve, to examine my own feelings, which I really didn't or hadn't had much time to do before this particular workshop. My mother died in February 2010, and the workshop was last year. So it gave me that opportunity to grieve in ways that I hadn't before.
And did you bring something for us to hear?
I did, and I hope that I can get through it. My poetry workshop that I focus on the blues, and I talk to women about writing the blues because I think it's a very unadorned way of getting at what one is really feeling. And so that was the lesson that I taught and the style of the poem that I wrote and read at last year's workshop. After a call to rush to the hospital in the middle of the night, walked in to see my mama, saw a body instead. I walked in to see my mama, saw her body instead. Wanted to come and say goodbye, but mama, she was dead. They took her breast to save her. Still, the cancer spread. Give up your breast and save your life. Didn't work. That cancer spread. Wanted to be there when mama left, but she was already dead. We knew this day would get here. That's what my mama said. Knew we were fighting but could not win. She smiled. She shook her head. She held on till I left her side. When I returned, my mama was dead.
Oh, Jarvis. You must be a wonderful teacher.
I don't know if I am or not, but I do hope that, as I said, that the workshop participants got something and allowed themselves to acknowledge breast cancer as the monster that it is. Last year, I wrote a piece for the paper that talked about how sunny and uplifting the months of October seem to be now with the kind of breast cancer messages. And I think what's often lost in those messages is that women are still dying and people are still dying of this particular disease. And it's easy to forget that with all the campaigns out there that women still die. The message can be understood as long as you do these particular things, you won't die from breast cancer. But my mother did everything that she could.
She
followed all the rules. She had all the checkups. She went to all the mammograms and still, you know, it killed her like it killed so many other people. So I wanted not to needlessly depress people, but just to remind everybody that this is still something we have to fight against, because it's still mm-hmm. killing a lot of women.
And it touches every aspect of life, you know, grieve, mourn, celebrate, remember, always remember.
Yes.
So thank you both. We've been talking with Jarvis DeBerry and Sharon Carter Sheridan about the Poems and Pink Ribbons Writing Workshop for those living with or who have survived breast cancer. The next session starts September 8th, and it will meet Saturdays from 10 a.m. to noon, September 8th through October 6th at the Rosa Keller Library, with a celebratory reading on October 13th. The library is at 4300 South Broad. To register, call Rashida Williams at 504-952-2773 or email poemsandpinkribbons@gmail.com. Sharon, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for having me.
Jarvis, I'm happy to see you. Good luck
thank
with
you.
The new baby.
Thank you.
Cornell Landry is back with book number Lucky 7. After the wild success of Goodnight Nola, and there are more than 50,000 copies of that book in print, and my favorite, One Dat, Two Dat, Are You a Who Dat, and several very happy books like Happy Mardi Gras and Happy Jazz Fest, it's time for football, with the Tiger and the Honey Badger take on the Zoo. Hi, Cornell.
Hi, Susan.
Welcome back to The Reading Life.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me back.
You've had a pretty great summer, I think.
Yeah, we had a really good summer.
You've been to the beach.
Been to the beach, yeah.
Been to Bonnaroo.
Been to Bonnaroo with my oldest daughter, yeah.
And you had a meeting with your biggest fan.
I had my biggest fan, Les Schwest from Lafayette, Louisiana. Yeah, he's a great kid.
So tell us what you did with Les.
I met Les when I went on a trip to Lafayette. I went to several schools in the Lafayette area and read to all the children. And when I was at one of the schools, I was primarily reading to the first and second graders. And a teacher came out with this little boy who looked to be about 4 years old. And she said, oh, my God, you have to meet this child. His name is Les Schwest, and he's your biggest fan. She says, trust me, he's in my class, and he carries Goodnight Nola with him everywhere he goes. And she showed me a picture of Les reading. Obviously, he can't read yet, so he knows the book verbatim. So he sat, and that she had a picture of him reading the book every day to the kids in the class, and they're all sitting, and he's flipping the pages. So I contacted his mother after the visit, and she and I became friends via email, and I expressed to her that I really would like for them to come to New Orleans so I could take Les on a tour of everything that was in the Goodnight Nola book. And prior to that, she had ordered the Monty the Lion book. So I drove to Lafayette and surprised him at a restaurant and gave him his copy of Monty the Lion and told him that the next week he was going to come to New Orleans and meet with me.
And that's going above and beyond, I think.
Yeah, we had a great time. We did everything in the book. We went to the Jackson Square. We looked at the Natchez, Café du Monde. We got beignets, and then we took him to get a praline. So it was really a really good trip.
That's a lucky little boy.
Yeah, we had a good time.
And you've also been at every single one of the library openings and the party for the summer reading program. And I've gotten to see you be a rock star a bunch of times.
Well, I don't know about that, but yeah, it was very fun. I've enjoyed all the openings.
Oh, well, it was great to see all those kids who do know all the words to your books.
Right.
So now, The Tiger and the Honey Badger Take on the Zoo.
Yes, The Tiger and the Honey Badger Take on the Zoo.
Let's hear about football.
Okay, this, most of my books, when as far as when I start to think about them, usually hits me in the middle of the night, and then I can't go to sleep, and then I kind of write them out. So this one started with a trip to the Lafayette area when I met Les, and every school I had gone to, the kids kept asking me, when are you going to do a tiger book? When are you going to do a tiger book? And I told each one of them that I hadn't really put any thought into it at all. So one night it started to intrigue me, and I kept thinking, well, if somebody put a bullet to my head, what would I do for a, you know, a tiger book? And so I sat and I thought about it one night and I said, well, what if a tiger challenged an elephant to a game of football, and the elephant, he told the elephant to come back with all of his friends, and the tiger and his best friend, who happened to be a honey badger, decided to take on the entire elephant and the rest of the zoo with his teammates. So that's sort of how it came about.
And then current events overtook you.
Correct, yes. The LSU's honey badger put a little kink into it. But we've said from the get-go that the story is, you know, I didn't want it to be for just 1 year, you know, that the football player from LSU was only going to be around for another year at most. So, you know, I would hope that the book would have longevity and for years to come, people would be able to enjoy it. And as Tiger fans, like we said, it's not necessarily LSU. It just happens to be about a tiger and a honey badger taking on an elephant. And his friends just happen to be a gator, a razorback, you know, a gamecock, a war eagle. So they just all happen to be SEC mascots.
That's right. Well, there you go. So I don't think it matters what's happened to the other honey badger.
I don't think it's going to matter at all. I really don't.
Your honey badger will endure. And this book is also illustrated by Sean Gautreaux.
By Sean Gautreaux, correct. Yes, he's now, this is my sixth book I've done with Sean, and each time he tries to outdo himself. And I thought he did his best work with the Happy Mardi Gras book, but he's really come close to it with this one. Each time we try to do a different style of artwork so that it doesn't get boring and each book looks exactly the same. So this one's more of like a watercolor style book, something you may have seen, kind of like a Winnie the Pooh-ish type of, you know, watercolor feel to it. So it's really good. And
yeah, they're
colorful.
Very charming animals. They all have good expressions. So what's next? Have your fans given you the next idea yet?
I don't know. I've talked to a few people that possibly want to do something with Mardi Gras Indians. I like the cultural ideas that we have for the city. So something maybe like a second line or the history of the second line, history of the Mardi Gras Indians, something along those lines. Are probably
well, I love it that your fans demanded a tiger book. Don't you love it when they come up to you and say?
I actually do. That was one where I never would have put a second thought into it. And then I guess after when we did the Mardi Gras book, it was the same thing with Sean. It just seemed like we would go to signings together. He and I went to literally four signings in a row within like a couple of days. And at every signing, somebody just happened to say, did you ever think of a Mardi Gras book? And we said, as a matter of fact, we did. And, you know, so this one, when I had gone to the schools, it was the same scenario, four or five different schools. And at each school out of the blue, some kid in the audience would raise his hand and say, hey, well, did you ever think about doing a tiger book? So that's pretty much how it came about.
Love of tigers never goes away.
That's right.
Well, Cornell, you are just the man in children's books about New Orleans. And I know folks are going to love this book just as much as the others. And it's here in time for Saint season. So couldn't be better.
That's right.
You can meet Cornell Landry when he signs The Tiger and the Honey Badger Take on the Zoo, September 1st from 2 to 4 at Barnes & Noble in Mandeville, September 8th from noon to 2 at Books a Million in Covington, September 12th at East Jefferson Hospital from 10 to 2, and September 15th at Octavia Books from 2 to 4. Thanks so much, Cornell.
You're welcome. Thanks again for having me.
I've been reading Jonathan Gottschall's wonderful book, The Storytelling Animal, about the reasons why we love stories, about what they do for us, and our ongoing need for them. As New Orleanians, we all love stories, and they come to us here in a number of ways. We love the stories that unfold in Mardi Gras parades. We all claim ownership of Tennessee Williams' streetcar named Desire, and John Kennedy Toole's A Confederacy of Dunces. And who doesn't know the story of Anne Rice's interview with a vampire? And now, a new generation of parents puts their children to bed with Cornell Landry's Goodnight, Nola. Face it, we can't go to the grocery store or the drugstore without coming home with a story. We love our family stories and the stories we read in the newspaper. We love to hear them. We love to tell them. And there's one story every New Orleanian over the age of 7 has, and that's a Katrina story. With the 7th anniversary of the flood upon us, here comes another round. All those stories begin with, the storm was coming, and quickly moved to, and then the levees broke. And from there, the plot lines diverge. I left, I stayed, I lost my father, my mother, my sister, my brother. I lost my house, I lost my dog. I never came back. I came back right away. I'm still trying to get back. I love New Orleans. I hate New Orleans. I've rebuilt. I can't rebuild. I miss. I love. I hope. In 2005, as we began to return, we shared those stories. The question was always, how'd you make out? We asked it of friends or complete strangers. We asked our mailmen, the checkers in the grocery store, the folks in the long lines at Walmart and Home Depot and Lowe's and rode home. We ask our children's teachers, our ministers, our co-workers. We crafted narratives, stories of loss and fear and hope and determination. Writers began to tell those stories pretty quickly, to us and to the world, in newspapers and magazines, on news shows and radio. And then books began to come. Soon there were shelves of them. First came news organization narratives from newspapers and networks. There were photography books and relief anthologies, from the gorgeous little Do You Know What It Means to Miss New Orleans to Rosemary James' New Orleans Mon Amour. Then came that heartfelt manifesto by Tom Piazza, Why New Orleans Matters. Then came chronicles by such witnesses as Anderson Cooper, Doug Brinkley, works by journalists like Jed Horn's Breach of Faith, Mark Schlefstein and John McQuaid's Path of Destruction, works by hurricane experts like Ivor Van Heerden's The Storm. The Times-Picayune published its pictorial history of events, and columnist Chris Rose had a bestseller with the grimly titled One Dead in Attic. Poetry came early and kept coming. Native daughter Nicole Cooley published The Powerful Breach. The great Niyo Sundari, who lost all his books and papers during the storm and was rescued from his attic along with his wife, is the author of City Without People, the Katrina poems. Eventually, we got fiction. Patty Friedman's A Little Bit Ruined came early on, as did Tony Dunbar's Tubby Meets Katrina. Tom Piazza rose to the occasion that first autumn with Why New Orleans Matters, then followed it up a few years later with City of Refuge, his tale of two families, one black, one white, and their lives during the storm and the year after. John Biganay turned his rage into drama with his powerful trilogy, Rising Water, Shotgun, and Mold. Countless mystery writers have set tales in the ruined city and after, especially James Lee Burke, whose Tin Roof Blowdown followed his story collection, Jesus Out to Sea. Many, many individuals published their own books. Doctors, nurses, firefighters, animal rescuers, ordinary folks like you and me. Josh Clark gave us an inside view of the quarter during the storm in Heart Like Water. Survival narratives like the two volumes Voices Rising 1 and 2 were published by UNO. Others, like former Mayor C. Ray Nagin and former recovery czar Ed Blakely, published their controversial accounts as well. There were great communal efforts, like that wonderful cookbook Cooking Up a Storm by Judy Walker and Marcel Bienvenu, which collected the work of the Recipe Recovery Project. For really, what books are as used and as beloved as cookbooks? Bibles, maybe. There were lots of children's books, too, usually about animals who made it through the storm somehow. The most memorable book to me was put together by Faith Kayemi, a teacher at St. Angela Merici School. Katrina, Our Teacher, was the name of that book. And it was the story of her students' experiences, leaving quickly, bundling up precious belongings and pets, traveling to relatives' homes or strange shelters, learning new skills, improvising, coming home at last, thinking about lessons learned. It was a work of the heart and hand, beautifully illustrated by those kids and loved into being by that teacher who was healing her students and herself. This year is filled with stories of recovery. Tom Wooten's We Shall Not Be Moved, Rebuilding Home in the Wake of Katrina, and Daniel Wolfe's The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back. Ron Thibodeau's stories of South Louisiana are collected in Hell or High Water, How Cajun Fortitude Withstood Hurricanes Rita and Ike, accounts of the challenges faced by our neighbors to the west. There are several mysteries, some good, some downright outrageous. Chris Wiltz has a darkly comic novel in ebook form, Shoot the Money, that describes the lives of women in the post-Katrina city. There are mysteries called Hell and High Water by Joy Castro and Cities of the Dead by Daniel Blake. How about a moratorium on those titles for a while, folks? I know that in the reading life of our city, these books occupy a complicated place. Some don't read them, don't want to look at them. Some collect them, but don't look at them, putting them away for the future. And some read them all, every word. For long years now, every August has brought its share of Katrina books, and that's a good thing, whether you read them or not. A sign that people still think about New Orleans, still write about what happened here, still remember. But maybe the stories that matter most to us are those that are written by hand or told by the human voice. The carefully copied out recipe, the treasured book rescued from a shelf high up in a moldy house. One of these stories might be just the one we need to move forward. A chapter in our narrative of resilience and strength and determination to reclaim our city's greatness. Jonathan Gottschall takes the title of his book from a quotation from Graham Swift's novel, Waterland. Man, let me offer you a definition, is the storytelling animal. Wherever he goes, he wants to leave behind not a chaotic wake, not an empty space, but the comforting marker buoys and trail signs of stories. He has to keep making them up. As long as there's a story, it's all right. Even in his last moments, it said, in the split second of a fatal fall, or when he's about to drown, he sees, passing rapidly before him, the story of his whole life. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Thomas Joseph Perez signs Katrina Lashes Arabia, Wednesday, August 29th at 6:30 at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. Poets Jarvis DeBerry, Gina Ferrara, and Lee Grew read from their work Saturday, September 1st at 2 p.m. at Ladder Library. Moira Crone discusses The Not Yet at 7 p.m., Tuesday, September 4th, at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Tal McThenia and Margaret Dunbar Cutright discuss and sign A Case for Solomon, Bobby Dunbar and the Kidnapping That Haunted a Nation, Wednesday, September 5th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Karma Wilson signs her children's book, Bear Says Thanks, Thursday, September 6th at 4 p.m. at Octavia Books. And coming up, the Dickens Fellowship of New Orleans will hold its first meeting of the year, Saturday, September 8th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Metairie Park Country Day School Bright Library. The reading for this gathering will be the first six chapters of Great Expectations. This year's books will be explored in discussions, lectures, and film screenings. For more information, write Dickens Fellowship at mpcds.com. Celebrate the work of Lafcadio Hearn at the Black Widow Literary Salon, with Priestess Miriam from the Rampart Street Temple reading about Marie Laveau, and Trixie Minx reading about glamour in NOLA. That's at 7 p.m. Monday, September 10th at Crescent City Books. Gary Michael Smith, an author, editor, publisher, and photojournalist based in New Orleans, conducts a seminar, How to Create Your Own Publishing Company, at 7 p.m. Monday, September 10th at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.